I'm Monica Taylor, and I'm happy to welcome to the second of my conversations with moral educators, a long-standing friend and colleague, David Rowse. I think perhaps, David, we should say that we've known each other for over 30 years, and we have had a respectful relationship coming at our common interest of moral values and moral education, personal social education, and so on, from somewhat different experiences, backgrounds, and perspectives, perhaps even. And in particular, we worked quite really very closely together for 5 to 10 years on a project called Values Education for Life in the UK. No doubt we'll want to say something about that later. And also in respect of your school, Values Education for Life, which I certainly want to ask you about later. David, unlike many of the people with whom I expect to have a conversation in this series, you've very much come to the area of our interest from a practical position, not from an academic position, and applying theory to practice, but from your experience of life and practice. So that's quite different from some other people, and I very much hope we shall be able to bring out some of your learning about this from actual practical living of life and education. We know, as educators, that often our formative years can be very influential. David, I hope you won't mind me saying that you're now in your mid-80s. And therefore, you were born just around the outbreak of World War II. And you've given me very kindly some personal reflections on aspects of your life alongside some other more formal documents that I'll refer to as we go along. But I wondered if you'd just say a little bit about your early memories in your family and in the community where you lived in central England, where you still live in that area, about growing up during World War II.
Hi everyone. Yes, indeed, Monica, and thank you for that kind introduction. I do go back. In fact, in what a month's time, I shall be 86. So I'm sort of galloping now through life and reflecting on the past. And yes, my early years. I remember very little about the early part of the Second World War, but I do recollect a fair bit toward the back end. Partly because I'd started school by then, and partly because I was obviously more conscious of what was going on around me as a young lad during a very difficult period. What do I remember? Well, I remember one or two things I learned something from quite profoundly at an early age. I've shared this with you before, Monica, but I remember seeing some going down to the local railway station with some friends. And watching these soldiers disembarking from a train, and women standing there and spitting and throwing abuse at them. And I just didn't understand, you know, why were they doing this? Because to me, as a child, somebody in uniform was a soldier or in the forces anyhow. And why would they do this? It wasn't until later on, and possibly having spoken to other people, that I realized that these were German prisoners of war. And the people spitting, the ladies, the women spitting and generally being very abusive, were probably women who'd have lost their husbands or sweethearts in the war, or perhaps they were in prisoner of war camps. And there was real hatred. And that's the very first time I experienced, I think, hatred, or at that intensity, very powerful, very strong. And you sensed it. You sensed it as not just a feeling, but something more intense than that. I learned from that that hate is very powerful indeed. Other things that I remember, we used to have a wonderful time because rather than having something like fire drill in those days, we had aircraft drill or drill going underground in twos, very politely, very properly, to the underground shelter next to the school on a fairly regular basis. So we had to do that and learn how to evacuate the school very promptly, because even towards the end of the war, there were single aircraft coming over and just doing random bombings without really, I guess, looking for anything much other than English people to bomb. What else do I remember about it? I remember very vividly my granddad. We were living with my grandparents for a time. He was an aged gentleman. He was 70, but in those days, 70 was an old age.
Definitely.
I remember that the siren went on this particular occasion for us to evacuate the premises that we were in. About 5 minutes away was an underground shelter, but by the time he got dressed,
Yes.
and I understand now why it took so long, and all the palaver of getting shoes on because he suffered from gout, etc. By the time we got to the top of the descent into the shelter, the all clear went. So we ambled back. I remember to this day him saying, "I'm not going to do that one again." And he didn't. He was quite determined. And whenever the sirens went, he lay in his bed and was quite determined not to be moved. And I think what he said on a number of occasions was, "If I'm going to die, I'm going to die in my own bed, not somewhere else." Anyhow, he died a natural death well after the end of the war. But I remember that.
That's
So there
really
was,
important,
sorry.
yes.
Sorry, Monica.
No, that so they were all your primary learning experiences about hate and love and fear, underlying your everyday existence, right? They're probably stronger experiences because of the circumstances and the context. I think my parents were of adult, adult age. They would have been more the age of your parents, perhaps not quite so, in World War II. And I often think nothing else ever as significant ever happened to them in their lifetimes. So it's interesting to learn from people like yourself who had some early experiences, not given to myself, who came along 10 years after you. Though I do remember seeing some of the bombed sites in Coventry near you, right? You mentioned playing in bomb sites, and also being in school, Church of England Primary School, where you had very much part of the curriculum was religious education, which we should say what to anybody listening to us, what we both know is RE was and indeed still is a statutory legal part of the British curriculum. And in those years that we're talking about in the 40s and 50s was a very powerful aspect of the curriculum. And given that, as we both know, moral education at that time was seen to be delivered through religious education, both in the school and if in your case, as it was in your case, the Church of England Primary School would have been even more so. So were there any things that you learnt from that, David, in retrospect, or how do you feel about that?
In that period, I recollect that religion, Christianity, still had a very profound effect upon people. A lot of people would have said quite naturally that they were Christian. A lot of people still went, maybe not regularly, but they certainly attended church or chapel on a reasonably regular basis. And people got married, of course they did, generally in church. And it was seen as a ceremony as opposed to an occasion, very different in many respects to people's lifestyle now. I was going to say prior to that, one of the very strong emotions that I had as a young person was living with my grandparents, and my grandmother was a very loving person. I experienced hate, as I've already said. I experienced love from my grandmother, and she still evokes in me, and I mean, it's a long time since she's died now, but she still evokes very strong emotions of love and care and compassion and so on. So I learned that from her. But as far as Christianity is concerned, of course, in our day, it was a very hard maxim. I progressed from the school to the local Methodist chapel, and everything was sinful. I mean, surely you remember, Monica, that breathing was virtually sinful. You could do absolutely nothing. And anything that you did do was highly suspect. But one of the things I remember again quite profoundly, we were attached to the local abbey or the abbey church. It had been an abbey in the past. And we used to go along there to the abbey church on a fairly regular basis for a service. And I remember sitting there in the church, it was an old part of the building going back several hundred years, and there was a huge cross with Jesus Christ hanging in agony. And I thought, I don't like that. I don't like the agony of it and the agonizing. Why not a bit more happiness, a bit more joy, and a bit more joie de vivre, as our French cousins might say. I remember that quite vividly. That had an effect on me.
Interesting.
But I stuck with it. And as I think I mentioned, at some point, I think I was 14, my first teaching job was as a Sunday school teacher, where I got told off by the superintendent because I wasn't teaching about Jesus Christ. I was teaching moral stories about and through the device of a itsy bitsy spider. I used to tell the kids stories, and I'd learned that ability. I got that ability from my grandma because she used to tell me stories, and they were somewhere in it slightly naughty. And kids love naughtiness. And if you want to get a young kid interested in what you're saying, tell them something slightly naughty, and they'll immediately prick their ears up. So I wasn't introduced to sort of the idea of Christianity being loving and caring and so on. And certainly one of the experiences at school which frightened me to death was the maths teacher. And she used to take us upstairs to a little room. This was a full class, turn where we had to sit on PE benches, but we turned them upside down. So instead of sitting on the full width of the bench, it was on a very narrow beam, and she used to go round, and we all had to learn our times tables up to 12 in those days, not 10, up to 12. And she'd say to somebody, six, six, six sixes. And if you hadn't got the response straight away, whack, a ruler came down over your hand, and ouch, six sixes, 36. You were scared to death, actually frightened out of you. Going up those stairs was like going to purgatory. You thought you were never ever going to come back. So it wasn't a happy time. It wasn't a time where everybody was it was quite in its way violent and aggressive. And I remember that.
And stern and firm.
Stern, yes.
Yes. David, you passed your 11 plus and went to grammar school, a well-known grammar school, I think, in Birmingham.
No, it wasn't. It was in Nuneaton. Poor old Nuneaton. I mentioned the name now, Nuneaton. Nuneaton,
In
it was King
Nuneaton.
Edward VI
Yes,
School.
all right. There is one of a similar name in Birmingham.
There is indeed,
Yes,
yeah.
that's why I'm confused. Yes. You progressed through that and you discovered that you've got a talent for art.
Yes, indeed. And I think, again, that's genetic because my father had quite an ability, totally untutored, but there nevertheless. And I'd always enjoyed drawing, and I have a vivid imagination. It's partly because I read a lot of comics when I was a young child, like Dandy and Beano. Which had, I'm not sure they always had a positive effect on my thinking, but nevertheless, they did amuse me. There was a small group of us. The school was very intellectually driven, very academic, and very science orientated. So I and we small group did not fit in all that well. But of course, there were possibilities with the school choir, which I joined. The drama society, which I joined, and other bits and pieces whereby we could express ourselves. But we did art, but it was not very well catered for, and it was seen very much as a sort of a second grade, second class subject.
Nevertheless, you persisted with that. You went to a College of Further Education and Art College to study that more formally. And indeed, you had a particular interest in printmaking. And you've mentioned to me that some prints were exhibited locally. And that you've even been contacted recently by the esteemed Victoria and Albert Museum in London to request permission to include a print of yours in a book that they're publishing about printmaking, which includes wor a work by Picasso. David, fame.
Well, I have to admit that if you find a piece of work with David Rouse signed at the bottom, it hasn't got the same worth. It's not as valuable in cash terms as one if it's got Picasso. And I've never actually signed a picture off Picasso because I'm not quite certain how to spell it properly. So I've never done that. But yes, I mean, that was out of the blue, utterly a surprise. And a delightful surprise, really, because I mean, that was a long time ago when I was at college, and they've stored this print all this time. It was a competition that I entered. I didn't win, but I got a complimentary prize, which meant that my print went on exhibition at the V&A, and then they kept it. And they've kept it all these years. And this person who's writing this book on lino cutting must have been going through the lino cuts that they got. They'd retained and found mine, and I got this letter saying, "Would you mind if we used it to
Amazing.
illustrate?" So yes, I was absolutely delighted. A voice, as it were, from the past.
Yes, indeed. Well, we should also perhaps break into the art scenario in your life because there was a break, and it was called National Service. That was something that was still in existence post-war. Indeed, by the time you went there, I believe, into it in around 1959, that's some time, 14, 15 years after supposedly the end of the war. And yet you were called up for 3 years. What was that kind of experience like, David? In relation to your moral, personal, social learning.
Well, first of all, 2 years national service. Some people did 3 years at the end, but most of us did 2 years. Out of the blue, I'd finished at college. I was writing off for jobs. But of course, if you hadn't got a job in those days, nobody said, ah, you got a letter through the post saying, report to Coventry, and we'll see if you're fit enough to be enrolled into Her Majesty's, or in fact, His Majesty's, I think at the time, I can't remember. But anyhow, into, in my case, the army. That happened. My experiences were really to ensure that whatever individualism you might still retain at a fairly early age and development in your life was eradicated so that you did what you were told. You weren't asked. People didn't say, "Look, chaps, I'm going to give the order to charge. Now, how do you feel about that? Do you want to discuss it at all? Would you like someone to sort of offload it to? Because I'm going to say it in a moment or two." I remember it sticks with you. An order was an order. It wasn't a please, could you? And if it wasn't obeyed, the answer was, "Well, if you're not going to obey it, appear outside the commanding officer's office tomorrow morning, best boots and gaiters. You're on a charge." Simple as that. There was no argument about it. There was no, or we're not going to, or etc. You did it, or else you're in big trouble. What did I learn from that? Well, I learned survival, I guess. Certain things which you can get away with, and certain things which you can't. And I wasn't at an age where I was enormously moral. Looking back, I guess we all did, all the youngsters, all the national service men, probably did from time to time some slightly naughty things which we shouldn't have done, really to survive, just to get by. But nothing really naughty, but just a bit iffy. Iffy.
As you say, it may be a condition of one's age at that time. One's still experimenting and so on, and trying to get round the rules a bit, test the boundaries. But there were clear rules and boundaries, nevertheless, in this case. You did mention to me that you thought that some of the effect of the being in this strictly disciplinarian organization, the army, was partly about stamping on personality. Wasn't a lot of opportunity to be an individual. It was about training and conformity and being part of a group, right?
You were a number.
You're a number.
You were given an army number, which I remember. I have a very poor memory, but I remember one or two things, and you do not forget your army number ever.
Interesting.
It's engraved on the inside of your eyeballs, I think. But anyhow, it's there, stuck there forever. And yes, you're quite right there. They're not interested in people. They're interested, that's not quite true. But overall, they are interested in the collective and not the individual. How does a collective, that is the Army Corps or the Army Regiment, or the army unit of whatever size it happens to be, how does it function? And does it function according to the rules and regulations that are laid down? And obviously it's quite strict, and you can't get 20 or 30 young men marching together unless you've got rules and regulations. But what I do remember, again, you've just reminded me, Monica, is once a week. We had this is this was during training. We had a comp everybody who's in training at the moment, which is over 1,000 young men, paraded, and we were inspected, make sure our kit was bubbly, shiny, gleamingly clean, and then we were marched off, or at least marched past somebody of some rank. The unit band used to come in and play. Now, I'll tell you something that a lot of people probably don't know. The orders were attention, and then it was parade, we'll march past in column a route. right, turn. And then number one company, by the left. In fact, it was by the right because it was dressing by the right. Quick march. Now, right-hand company in English units. What tune would they march off to?
No idea.
British Grenadiers, because the right-hand company of all units is the Grenadier Company. So you start with number one company, Grenadiers, and they marched. And you moved up, but so you became eventually, before you went off to wherever you were posted to, you were the Grenadier Company for that particular day. I never forget that. There are bits and pieces that stick in you. It's strange, isn't it, how they do?
Yes. Well, you said you have a poor memory, but that's a very clear memory from at least 65 years ago. Now, of course, many people in our field will have not had that kind of experience at all, at least not in our country. Although there are other countries, of course, that still have national service or some kind of very strict disciplinary training period, if I can call it that. But this was at the time of the Cold War, so there was a real possibility, it was thought, of some other kind of war experience. And indeed, even into the 70s, we were practicing for in case of a nuclear event, right? You came out of national service and went into teaching, and we're probably going to compress what was 28 to 30 years of your life here, because you had, I think I'm right in saying you started as an art teacher, and then you went through two or three schools, doing art, progressing to a broader PSHE kind of experience, and through the management. And in that time, you also continued under your own, seems to me, instigation to educate yourself more formally. Because when you went into teaching, I think it would be interesting to our colleagues for you just to explain what happened. You had no, absolutely no teacher training experience, did you?
I wasn't qualified. I wasn't, we did no teaching practice. I was completely, apart from my little bit of experience with a small group of kids at the chapel for Sunday afternoons. No, nothing at all.
No.
My introduction to teaching was arriving at a Birmingham school in a deprived area, a secondary modern school for boys. And I was introduced to the head teacher, who rapidly retreated to his office and shut the door. And I probably locked it if he got any sense. I was marched along the corridor by the deputy head, who opened the door. And there were 35 young boys, 14 aged, waiting for me. And I remember to this day the deputy head saying, "There's your class. There's the key to the stock room. If you have any problems." And I think what he really meant, what he said, "Let me know." But I think really what he was saying was, "Don't bother me with them." And he departed rapidly, closing the door behind him. And that was my introduction to teaching. And I didn't know that I was going to teach on that day. I didn't know I was going to be asked to do something. I thought maybe I would be sort of taken around and introduced to various people, etc. But no, if you pay to do teaching, you teach. And I did. I got by. I'm still here, so proof that
Yes,
I managed
indeed.
to survive.
Yes. Well, you've already described how you learned certain things already about the teaching learning experience, if you liked, by some storytelling, a bit of naughtiness, all those things. Well, at that time, David, was there still corporal punishment in school?
Again, a little story. I'd been there a few months when, if you remember, immediately after the war, they were so short of teachers, they took a lot of people on with minimal training. I think it was a matter of a few months' training. Anyhow, one of these gentlemen came round with a catalogue and he sidled up to the side of me and he said, "Which of these would you like?" Sorry. "Which of these would you like? You're allowed one every year." It was a catalogue of canes. "The swishy ones hurt 'em, but the thicker ones you can beat 'em hard with." He didn't actually say that, but it was Dickensian in a sense. And there it was, a catalogue full of canes, and I was allocated a cane once a year, and the only restrictions placed on caning was that you couldn't do it in front of the class. You had to take a young person, to a corner of the hall, and you had to put it in the punishment book and how many strokes you'd actually given them. I have to confess, I tried it once and felt it was not for me, so I didn't do it ever again. I didn't see the purpose of it, and it didn't give me any feeling of I'd achieve very much by doing it. But yes, it was rife. I mean, seriously, I've seen a sort of a small queue of staff and pupils waiting outside the door into the hall for a corner of the hall to become vacant.
Really,
Yeah.
I think I've probably told you this before. My own father was a primary school teacher, did emergency teacher training after the war, so there was some in 1947, eight, right, having come out of the army. And he was often, because he was a primary school teacher, and as you'll well know, men are less likely to be teaching in primary schools than women. He was often asked, or directed to administer the cane by the head teacher. I know it seriously upset him that he felt it was inappropriate. Now, of course, it must have been thought to have had an effect that would be beneficial, both on the student, who the miscreant, and the school, presumably. Otherwise, why would it have been a persistent practice?
I think, Monica, the answer to that is coming back to Kohlberg and stages of reasoning. Fear. The army worked to a very large extent on fear. And I think the whole idea of discipline in schools at that time might have been based not wholly and not everywhere, but to some extent, certainly on fear of consequence. If you are fearful of, you won't do it. If the consequence is being hurt, then you will think twice about doing it. I think that was a sort of the underpinning. I won't say philosophy because it's not really a philosophy.
No, that's interesting because you've mentioned fear in this conversation before, and that was really in partly in association with your memories of religious education and the crucifixion, right? And of course, religion was often taught in a fearful kind of way. Christianity, I'm of course referring to here, in our common experience in the UK, that life was to some extent a preparation for the life hereafter. And so there was a certain amount of fear in all of that. You had to behave well in the present to possibly get some rewards later.
I think that was very true, and I think that most people believed in a life hereafter, and self-preservation again. You know, if you want to go to the place where you're most likely to be happy, as we were told, then you needed to be good,
Yes.
and you needed to do certain things to be good. For example, we had to learn our catechisms when I was at school. This is primary school, because it was deemed to be important that all young people, all good young people, would know their catechisms and say them on a regular basis. And we did. So, although, if I remember correctly, it was only sort of, you know, it wasn't remembered and inwardly digested. It was something that we just said without really understanding it.
Yes,
But you had to say it.
absolutely, and it was taken literally. I remember because in the village here where I have come back to live, where I had my adolescence, going to church, being part of the choir, was about the only social activity open to one as an adolescent. There was no youth club, no going on the bus into the nearest town, all that kind of thing. And in order to, be in the choir, I couldn't sing, but it was something you did just to belong and see your peers. But I remember the rector preached a series of sermons and asked us for questions. And I remember distinctly asking, why is heaven always referred to as above and hell as below? And he preached a whole sermon on it. I'm afraid I don't remember his pearls of wisdom, but I think that just indicated how it was. You were expected just to take this all literally and not to actually ask these kinds of questions. What is really going on here? Was not really an acceptable kind of approach. But as we know, David, I've now moved us on into perhaps the late 1960s, early 70s. Society was beginning to change post-war, and there was the emergence of what we now have, a much more diverse, culturally diverse, multicultural, ethnically diverse society. And so in our lifetimes, we've seen how that's grown. Though, of course, we have to acknowledge, as you would know through art, that people from different ethnic backgrounds have always been part of British society. As you said recently, to a Japanese colleague and I at AME last November in New York, well, since the Vikings, right, we've been a mixed society. It just hasn't been recognised. And you would have seen that as part of your teaching experience. The nature of the classroom would have been changing. Just as it was indeed slightly as I was still experiencing it, though I happened after I ceased living in the Midlands in your area, where I live in East Anglia is a very white area still to this day, largely. Do you think that influenced any of your teaching and learning, David?
I wasn't conscious of that. I didn't meet my first person of colour that I met was I'd be about, gee golly gosh, what, about seven, 6 or 7. And my grandparents had got a shop at the time, and he came in. And he was selling tea towels. And I'd never met anyone before at all. The whole of England, people forget this, we were going through a transition. You know, we were moving from very local groups to globalization in a very brief period of time. And my wife comes from Atherston, which is next door to Nuneaton. And Nuneaton believe that all Atherston people are completely mad. And all Atherston people believe that all Nuneaton people are completely stupid. And that isn't just about Nuneaton. Generally, I mean, within the towns, within, for example, Atherston, there are about six or seven, or were six or seven families, two of which have been there since and could trace it back directly. And they're just ordinary people, but could trace it back directly to the Norman conquest, had lived there since then in Atherston. And everybody knew everybody else. It was a very tight-knit community. There wasn't the travel that you get now. I mean, people didn't go to work. There are still houses. They weren't in use when I was young, but they, at some point, not too far before that, houses with the actual workshops in the top story of the house. So people went upstairs, as it were, to work. There were cottages at the bottom, but the top was one long room, which was a workshop where they all worked together.
Indeed. So things have gone round in a circle, right? Home
Yes.
working now, post-COVID.
Absolutely, yes. But the sense of community and family, I mean, that's something which has suffered enormously. And
So I what I was wondering really was, society's always in a developmental state, right? It's never static. But there were big changes in society that I think it's easy to gloss over because there was becoming to be a much more questioning of the foundation of moral values, such as we've discussed briefly in relation to religious education and the underpinning of the Christian religion. And our education system, if it excels in anything, or perhaps we should say if it excelled in anything, was it taught us to have a critical eye, a critical approach to what we were or are being told, right, by authority, and to interrogate our sources and so on. That's what we would have learned primarily from our educational experiences. So this was beginning to be applied to moral values and personal social education, religious education, citizenship education, as it became known later in the 90s. So you and your experiences, both as a child to adolescence in the army and as a teacher, and in view of the background influences you told us about little of, you were becoming more interested, would this be right to say, in some young people who were a bit at the margins, even in the mainstream, in your comprehensive technical schools that you were teaching in for 30 years, there was a change in the way young people were behaving, perhaps, and how they were perceived, and their needs and interests. Have I categorized this at all well for you to say something meaningful about how your interests evolved?
Well, I have to say that one of the things about life, of course, is it's dreadfully unfair. There's no justice right from the very beginning. Nobody asks me, who would you like your mum and dad to be? What genetic traits would you like? You know, I never got a form to fill in. I just got what I got. And it was very much a working class beginning. My dad got paid, I remember when I was young, because I heard them talking, £1, the equivalent of one, what would it be? £1, 35 shillings a week, of which 7 and 6 months was rent for the house we were living in. And People were, they had no money at all, if the truth be known. I mean, times were grim and hard. They really were.
Absolutely. Yes. I came from a similar sort of background in that respect. There was no money.
So, you made the most of what little you got. You really did. And that meant people relying on each other. The days of go next door and fetch a cup of sugar, ask them, and then it would be returned at a later date when was possible to do so. But people shared things much more willingly
Absolutely.
because they got so little themselves. So it was desperate. It was survival times. But yeah, hard times to go through in the
They
beginning.
were, but that was a community, right? And what did you see was happening in school? I mean, what made you, I mean, you were able to take early retirement after 30 years in the education system, in the mainstream, right? In secondary comprehensive schools with some, I imagine, quite challenging pupils, some of those schools. And what would, how did your own interest in them and what they were learning and what they were getting out of education evolve in that time, would you say, David? I mean, it's a big period, it's a big chunk of one's life, 30 years.
I think the answer to that, Monica, is the fact that you need within the teaching of anything, but certainly within morality, within values and so on, you need some practical experience. It can't all be theory. Some kids just don't learn from books, or they find it difficult to. Hands-on, great. If you're asking them to do it from a book, they're not so good. And what I tried to do was introduce things which were hands-on and get them engaged in what they were doing. One of the magic moments, I've had one or two, not many, in education. And with one class that I got on very well with, we had a very good rapport. And they would come in, they would sit down, and they would look at me and wait for me to start the lesson. And I thought, yeah, this is rubbish. This is their lesson. I'm here to help them. I'm the paid helper here. So anyhow, they came in this one day, and I just sat there, and they started shuffling, looking at each other, puzzled. And I just put my hands out. I didn't say a word. I just put my hands out, a sort of a giving motion. And several of them immediately got immediately what I wanted. I was doing was saying, this is your lesson. What are you going to do about it? You know where the work is. You know where the stuff is. Why are you waiting for me to tell you what you know already you need to do? And the whole lot got up. And that was a magical moment because they got it. And you could tell it had had a profound effect upon many of them that, yeah, this is absolutely, this is my life. This is mine. And I need to take responsibility for it. Not, he's not responsible for what's going on. He's here to help. I'm responsible for what I learn and what I do. So everything that I did after that, I tried to include some kind of practice in.